All right. Welcome to this session is Evolution Ideas 2. You're going to hear two talks, one of which is really wacky, and the other one, I'm not sure, but I think it's a little wacky. And that's why we're Evolution Ideas 2, because Evolution Ideas 1, you may remember, was yesterday. That was less wacky. Well, except it didn't. I'm really very, my name's Cy Gart. I'm the moderator and the first speaker. And I'm really very happy that Jeff Schloss gave his talk which was, besides being a great talk, as expected, it really serves as an introduction to what I'm going to talk about. So that was, but I'm going to talk about only one tiny aspect of the huge field that he covered. But it does have to do with teleology and biology and the whole issue of teleology and evolution, which is something, I don't know if any of you heard my talk last year at this meeting, but that was the title of that talk. This one's a little different. I'm going to be talking about something I invented called intrinsic biochemical intelligence and design. And the basic idea of this nice acronym, IBI, is that single cells are intelligent. And when I first saw this, it was actually in a blog by Perry Marshall, who had a link to a TED talk by a scientist named Bonnie Brasler. And I don't have that video embedded, but it's easy to find online. Just look up Bonnie Brasler TED. And she showed some beautiful pictures showing the intelligence of colonies of bacteria. And what it turns out is that what she showed was that bacteria, once they get together in groups, when the group gets large enough, they somehow know it, and they then do things which are only work if a large group of cells do it at once. For example, they produce light. Now, if one bacterial cell produces light, it's useless, but if several million do, you actually see a flash. Or they produce toxins, which won't do anything to anybody, but if a million bacteria produce a toxic chemical all at once, it has a deadly effect. So there is something about the bacteria that know when there are enough of them around in order to do something. And she talks about bacteria being intelligent. When I looked into this idea, it turns out that it's actually fairly widespread. I have several slides of quotes. I decided to cut them down to just three quotes. This is from a 2010 paper. Cells are essentially autonomous, sentient, and ingenious. They create and regulate activity. They respond to current conditions, and crucially, they take decisions to deal with unforeseen difficulties. James Shapiro has said many things about this. Just say that cells are cognitive entities possessing great computational power. And finally, a friend of mine, One Pagan, who has written a great book about planarians. So this is not just single cells, but just we're even talking about very simple animals. Planarians are, the reason he's interested in them is they have the most primitive nervous system. It barely functions as a nervous system. And he's talking about slime molds here, which are capable of behaviors like problem-solving skills and the ability to learn. Now, if you look at all of these descriptions, and as I said, there are many more like this from the literature, what you find is descriptions of what we often think of as intelligence. Of course, that raises the immediate question. But wait a minute. None of the bacteria don't have brains, nor do slime molds, nor do any of these things. How do you have intelligence without a brain? Isn't intelligence simply a function of neurological complexity in brains? And that's true for what we know as intelligence, animals, basically, us, and other animals. And they have this neural-based intelligence, and they also get sensory feedback. And that's how they deal with the world. Okay, they see, hear, sense, smell, etc. And they use their brains to be smart and do all those things. However, single-cell intelligence, obviously, we're not talking about neural intelligence. It's the you could call it the appearance of intelligence, but you could just call it a different form of intelligence. And that is not based on complex neural networks, but on complex biochemical pathways. And to give you an example, cells communicate. The example I first started out with, Bonnie Bassler's groups of bacteria, and the way they communicate is, it seems fairly simple when you first hear about it. They just use proteins, which are signals, which then travel out from the cell and bind to a receptor on another protein. And the result of that binding is, hey, you're not alone. You got a friend over there somewhere, close enough to be able to send out the signal. So that's a communication, which then leads to all kinds of other things. What else do cells do? Well, they do many things. One of the things cells do is they can evolve. And, of course, all life evolves, all life as we know it evolves. And how do cells evolve? Well, I'm going to go into that in some detail. I'm not going to talk much about the cell-cell communication part, but I am going to talk about the evolution. And what is critical to know about evolution is that it just doesn't happen. It's not just something that life does. It requires a very specific, complex biochemical mechanism, without which there is no evolution. And I'm going to go into that in some detail. And I'm going to talk about that and how that relates to intrinsic biochemical intelligence in cells. So just one slide on the first thing I'm talking about, which is signaling. Okay, so we see a signal molecule which binds to a receptor on the outside of a membrane, for example, and there are many variants of this kind of process. Once the binding occurs, several different biochemical steps occur, which is are called signal transduction, and the signal eventually ends up doing something, often stimulating expression of a particular gene, and often there are cascades. This can be extremely complex. And our cells do it as well, not just all cells do this. It's an important part of how multicellular organisms are able to work together in one organism, the cells of which use this kind of signaling. And one thing that I read when I was looking into this a little bit, and it never dawned on me, but of course it makes perfect sense, is that the vast majority of your somatic cells don't even know there's a brain. Okay, they don't care about brains, they don't care about nerves. What they actually respond to are chemical signals that travel and then reach them and tell them what to do, either hormones or intercellular communication signals of various kinds. So the fact that there's a brain, they probably don't believe in brains. They say, show me the evidence. Okay, so that's it. That's all I'm really going to say about you know, the intercellular communication. I really want to talk about evolution, since, you know, that's the main interest here. And when we think about evolution, we don't often think of the mechanism of evolution, and I do. And the mechanism is somewhat of a cycle. We start with a DNA genotype of some kind, which produces proteins of a very specific kind, and those proteins are the phenotype of the cell. It's the environment that acts on that phenotype in natural selection. And if the environment results in a favoring one phenotype over another, that then feeds back into the genotype, because if you remove a cell with a particular phenotype, you've also removed the cell with that genotype that codes for that phenotype. So there has to be a very tight linkage between genotype and phenotype in order for evolution to work, because the environment does not act on your genotype. The environment also doesn't know that there's a DNA molecule. All it knows is this bird, you know, flies better than that bird. That's a phenotype. So the linkage between genotype and phenotype must be very strong and very tight. And natural selection, as I said, acts on that process, as does heredity. Heredity has to be very good. Without perfect, almost perfect, not complete, but almost perfect heredity, replication of DNA, you don't get evolution, because if you make, if you're great, but your kids don't inherit your greatness, evolution doesn't happen. And what I'm going to talk about in more detail is this other step from genotype to phenotype. And that involves a lot of very complex, very difficult biochemistry, which I think is quite beautiful. And so just to go through this, for the, if there are any non-biologists or non-biochemists in the room, there may be one or two. What is this all about? Okay, this is sort of the original dogma of molecular biology. DNA eventually is, DNA is a code, as we know, and what it eventually does is it codes for specific proteins of a specific sequence and a specific functionality. But that's very hard to do chemically, because nucleic acid chemistry and amino acid chemistry don't go together. If you throw nucleic acids or even DNA and RNA into a beaker and you throw amino acids in, nothing happens. So there's a translation that has to go, and that is the technical name for the term, translation, where you are translating nucleic acid chemistry, the sequence of a DNA and of an RNA molecule, into amino acid chemistry, which is the sequence of a protein. That is a very difficult biochemical challenge to overcome. I'm not sure that we asked to do it could figure out how it was done, and in fact, it took quite a while in the 1950s and 60s to figure out this process. And that's a very complicated process. I've listed a whole list of some of the components of that process: transfer RNA, messenger RNA. I'm going to talk about number three, the aminoacyl tRNA synthase, which is my favorite enzyme in the world, and ribosome, and lots of other stuff, because there are all kinds of proteins and cofactors and correction things, signals and all kinds of stuff. And this process has to be as almost as accurate as replication, because if you have a DNA sequence code and it says to make protein Y, and you don't make protein Y, you make protein Y prime or protein Y with a few changes in it, no evolution. So this is another process that must be very error-free for evolution to work. Now, to look at the translation process, you can look at online and see thousands of these cartoons, how it all works. And this shows many of the components, and I'm not going to talk about any of them. Basically what it shows is you have the gene in the nucleus, it's transcribed into an RNA, which has the complementary sequence, leaves the nucleus, goes to the ribosome, and these funny shaped things are tRNAs that have anticodons that bind to the mRNA, and they're also bound to a very specific amino acid, which then gets ligated. That's the simple version, okay? So, but there's one incredibly important step that's missing, and it is the actual translator. So far, nothing here has translated nucleic acid to protein, to amino acids. And that is not shown here. And what is missing is you see the little green dots, which are the free amino acids. How do the tRNAs know which green dot to take? They have an anticodon on their other end for leucine, and now they have to pick up leucine. How do they do that? And the answer is they don't. There is an enzyme that does that. It is the translation molecule. It is the key, the Rosetta Stone, which has the nucleic acid information on one part and the amino acid information on the other part, and here it is. There are many tRNAs, at least one for each amino acid, there are at least 20, there are a few extras. And each one of these is specific for amino acid. Each one has several amazing features. It has a binding site to the amino acid, which is very specific for that amino acid. It has a binding site for the tRNA, which has the anticodon for that particular amino acid. And each one is different. So there's a red one for glycine, a green one for leucine, etc. And what you see, the way I've drawn this, is that the shapes of the amino acids fit the receptors for themselves, and the tRNAs fit perfectly into their binding sites. Now, that's a highly oversimplified version, but I don't have a lot of time to go into the details, and I won't. But that's not all. So here is a picture of both of these AA aminoacyl tRNA synthases with their amino acid on one side, on one binding site, with their tRNA on the other binding site. And then, for example, in this case, the two are put together with a very complex chemical reaction requiring ATP, energy, etc. And so we now have the correct amino acid attached to the correct tRNA. And now it can go off. The tRNA has its little green dot with the right anticodon on it. It goes to the ribosome, and it's the amino acid is put in exactly the right place it's supposed to be according to the genetic code. But that's not all, because mistakes are made. A lot of amino acids look the same. They may be, one gets confused for another, and that can't work. So this enzyme also has an editing site. One of the problems that can happen is if you have a binding site, which is the top site, okay, the one on the top, which fits a particular amino acid, what if a smaller one comes in? That could fit into that binding site as well. And then sometimes that will happen. So there is another site in the protein called an editing site. And what happens is when the amino acid binds to the first site, the binding site, it is removed and it is sent to the editing site to see if it fits. If it didn't fit, it goes back where it was supposed to be. But what if you have an amino acid that doesn't belong in that binding site? It's too small, okay? It's the wrong amino acid. Look at the binding site. The binding site is smaller, and it's shaped, and it has other properties of it that will accept everything that isn't the correct amino acid. And if that goes in there, it fits perfectly, and then the enzyme degrades it. So the mistake will not even be made. That's one example of error correction. There are many others that occur later, but this is my favorite because all of this is on the same protein. I love this enzyme. So, what does all this mean for the issue of intelligence, intrinsic biochemical intelligence? What does it mean for evolution? Well, what is the feedback for all of this, okay? Because remember I said that animals, creatures with brains, not only can think and process information, but they also have to get information from the environment. What happens with individual cells or non-conscious, non-thinking cells? And, well, these protein sequences, which are determined by the genetic code and the translation machinery, both of which, as I said, have to work really well. We're talking about errors of 0.0001%. Okay. But when you get it right, that protein has a particular function. And that function is important for the cell. And the reason it's important is because the cell has already evolved to be in that position. Changes in that sequence could be highly detrimental. They could also possibly and rarely be beneficial, but that does happen. So when the DNA mutates and DNA replication does have an error rate, thank God, because if it was a zero error rate, there would be no evolution. And mutations will produce changes, some of them. Most of them are neutral. Most of them don't do anything. But some of those mutations could produce changes in the protein function. And if that's a critical function, that might be bad. Most likely it will be. So these changes could be physiologically to the cell, physiologically harmful, most are neutral, and a few may even be beneficial. Okay, so there's an immediate feedback to the cell. Again, it's not a visual feedback or a sensory feedback. It's a biochemical feedback to the cell, where the changes that occur through mutations, through errors in this process, are basically telling the cell, that was a big mistake. Or, wow, you got lucky. That's a good idea. And That immediate feedback that's given to the cell from changes in health due to the mutation is, of course, what then feeds into the longer, much more elaborate process of natural selection. If the change is bad enough, the cell will die. It will not have progeny. If it's really good, that cell may do better and eventually dominate the population, which means that genotype change will dominate the population. Now, what about this whole story of evolution in proteins? And this is a slide not about evolution, but about intelligent human design. And this is showing what happens in laboratories, in commercial laboratories that are trying to produce proteins for very specific purposes. So this is artificial selection. And what is done in these processes is you take a protein which you want to improve, okay, you want to make some functional improvement on the protein, and you do random mutagenesis. You just mutate it, you throw in mutagens, you change it chemically, biochemically, whatever, any way you want, and you get lots and lots of different mutations. And then you do a screen for activity in vitro, okay? Whatever that process is, whatever the function of the protein is, you look to see what is working. Do you get what you were trying to get? This is highly teleological. You have a purpose. You want to get a protein with a specific function. And you may have to do it several times. And you throw out everything that doesn't work. You throw out everything that doesn't work better. And you keep the few things, the evolved protein, which is what you want. And, okay, that's simple in a way. It's not, but anyway, at least theoretically, that is artificial selection. It's the same way we made, you know, better grapes and everything else for the last several centuries, artificial selection. And I put it up here because it's actually, in this case, kind of similar to what happens in nature, except we think of natural selection as doing the screening. And the screening is based basically on how well do you live, how well do you survive, how well do you reproduce offspring. So the point I would like to make is that when we think of evolution, and I'm still talking about single cells, but this could be extended further, is a product of that intrinsic biochemical intelligence. Think back to the AA tRNA synthase and all the processes that go on in translation, and natural selection, which is the ultimate feedback from the environment to the cell. So to repeat, cellular protein synthesis with environmental feedback from natural selection results in the evolution of proteins and cells with increasing fitness. That's standard evolutionary ideas. I'm proposing that this process resembles an intelligent system in the same way that signaling evokes comparisons with higher level intelligence, where groups get together and decide to do something, but it's actually not thought, it's biochemical. So therefore, if we think of evolution as a process of intelligent design, which is, you've heard Dennis and others say that earlier in the meeting, then the designer could be the cell itself as an intelligent designer. And just to end, I would say that all of Jeff Schloss's comments about teleology fit in here, I think, very well, because I strongly believe that teleology is part of biology way back to the beginning when the first cell began doing this kind of process. And you could ask yourself, well, if the cell is an intelligent agent, how did we get intelligent cells? And that is the question that will be answered not today. Thank you. We have time for a couple of questions. And we're not going to pay too much attention to time because after David speaks, we're free. So, yeah, Craig, sorry.
Well, you said the cell can be the the designer would be the cell itself.
Right.
And this I'm thinking back to Randy's talk where he made a distinction between things that happen in biology, cells, processing the cells, versus human design processing. I think that is
I don't see Randy. Good.
That's
right. I remember. So Randy and I have argued about this for about 4 years, maybe.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry to interject.
I don't completely agree with Randy, and he doesn't completely agree with me. We've talked about teleology, for example. I see teleology as a fundamental part of biology going all the way back. Randy's not so sure. So, yeah. It's
purpose, and again, that word also can be defined in different ways. I think all of these terms you can really part in great detail. Purpose, what do you mean by purpose? What's the source of the progress? What do you mean by progress?
Right.
That
right.
was actually covered nicely in the last plenary.
Yeah, well,
as
I said at the very beginning, I felt that Jeff's talk, you know, was a great, at least for me, was a great introduction to what I wanted to say. Or maybe it should be the other way around, but either way, I think they go together. And Jeff and I are a little bit more on the same page when it comes to teleology. So Anne and then Lauren.
So I just wanted to make a comment. I don't know if you've seen a video on YouTube of the ribosome in action as based on a molecular model of the actual movements of the ribosome.
There are so many. I don't know.
Okay, well, this is the best I've seen.
Okay.
You know that there are conformational changes in the proteins as the ribosome.
Yes.
This ribosome looks like he's reaching out an arm, grabbing hold of the tRNA, bringing it in, and then removing it out the other side with another arm. It's the most freaky thing I've ever seen.
Look, I have to tell you, when I was in graduate school, I was an atheist. And I learned about the translation system, and I felt a spiritual chill go up and down my back. And I didn't know what it was. I now know what it was. The translation system, if you haven't seen any videos on it, please just look at it. It's incredible. So I agree.
So what you presented helps illustrate some of the machinery that help, or some of the evolutionary processes that help cells go from single cells to colonies to multi-cell.
Right.
Have you thought about what took so long? If that machinery was in place with very early in the history of life, why 3 billion years?
Right.
Have you thought about why that took so long?
Yeah, I have, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, we had life. We're now back to, somebody may correct me. I believe it's 3.9 billion years ago, or almost 4.
Or
2.
4.2? Between 4.2 and 3.7.
Okay, somewhere in there. But, you know, we're talking about, like, the day after the end of the heavy bombardment, right? The next day, there was life. And, you know, it's like, are you done? Okay, thank you. And you know, life appeared. But then it took 2 billion years to get to the next step. And what was going on? And I think the answer is evolution is not easy. What we know is that very, very early life, which people call LUCA, the last universal common ancestor, already had this system. It had all of these complex systems already in it. That's hard to explain. But once it had it, you know, there was a lot of bacterial evolution, which still goes on, long before, you know, the mitochondria, whatever that cell was that came in and made eukaryotes. So there was still evolution happening. Things were getting better. You know, the processes were being fine-tuned, being improved, etc. This went on for a long time. Why it took so long, I don't know. But I'd love to find out.
There is a stromatolite deposit. Well, stromatolites exist, which, I mean, it's not like a really big colonization there, but they have them all the way back to like 2.5 billion years.
Oh, the stromatolites go further back than that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like rock deposits.
Yeah. Great.
I'll just say that part of what you see from that immense amount of time is the biochemical perfection that's in microbes.
Exactly.
That is not necessarily seen in eukaryotic cells.
Exactly.
To the same extent.
Yeah, I mean,
they had so much time to tinker, if you will, with their biochemistry that it's almost to the diffusion limit of the speed of certain enzymes.
Absolutely. And Stephen Jay Gould, of course, used to say that, you know, we should not be arrogant because bacteria are so much better than we are.
Biochemically.
Right.
A lot of time to work on.
I think, one more question because I don't want to be.
When I was a freshman,
about teleology and that there is no such thing.
That's right.
But as I, in my research lab, and as I study signal transduction in one cell of the immune system and how it starts all to work together and the incredible complex pathways of what has to phosphorylate what and what has to translocate to the nucleus and what other things get flooded, it just seems as though there's this incredible intelligence. So I like your idea of how intelligent a cell is. And I don't know how you get from the very beginning simple things to more complicated things.
Yeah.
But I am a theistic evolutionist, so I think it's a gorgeous system.
Thank you. I see Jim Peterson's not here, but if I write this paper for PSCF, I'll ask him to use you as a reviewer. Thanks.